Southeast of Columbus, the gloom was no less heavy for being fitful. During the week since the fall of its sister fort across the way, the atmosphere at Donelson had been feverish, with a rapid succession of brigadiers hastening preparations for the attack which each believed was imminent. First had come the fugitives from Henry, shamefaced and angry, with lurid details of the gunboat's might and the host of Federals whose trap they had eluded. Brigadier General Bushrod Johnson assumed command the following day, an Ohio-born West Pointer who had left the Army to teach school in Tennessee and, liking it, offered his services when that state seceded. 2 days later, on the 9th, Gideon Pillow arrived from Clarksville, relying on the courage and fidelity of the brave officers and men under his command. He exhorted them to drive back the ruthless invaders from our soil and again raise the Confederate flag over Fort Henry. Our battle cry, liberty or death. Simon Buckner marched in from Russellville next day. All this time, John B. Floyd was hovering nearby with his brigade. Johnston had told him to act on his own discretion, and he rather suspected the place of being a trap. By now, Pillow had recovered from his notion of launching an offensive, but he wrote, "I will never surrender the position, and with God's help I mean to maintain it." Encouraged by this show of nerve, Floyd arrived on the 13th. Donelson's fourth commander within a week, he got there at daybreak in time to help repulse the first all-out land attack. Grant's army had come up during the night. The Federals were apt to find this fort a tougher nut than the one they had cracked the week before. Like Henry, it commanded a bend in the river, but there the resemblance ceased. Far from being in danger of inundation, Donelson's highest guns, a rifled 128-pounder and two 32-pounder carronades, were emplaced on the crown of a 100-foot bluff. Two-thirds of the way down, a battery mounting a 10-inch Columbiad and eight smooth-bore 32-pounders was dug into the bluff's steep northern face. All 12 of these pieces were protected by earthworks, the embrasures narrowed with sandbags. Landward, the position was less impregnable, but whatever natural obstacles stood in the path of assault had been strengthened by Confederate engineers. To the north, flowing into the river where the bluff came sheerly down, Hickman Creek, swollen with backwater, secured the right flank like a bridgeless moat protecting a castle rampart. The fort proper, a rustic sort of stockade affair enclosing several acres of rude log huts, was designed to house the garrison and protect the water batteries from incidental sorties. It could never withstand large-scale attacks, such as the one about to be launched, however, and the engineers had met this threat by fortifying the low ridge running generally southeast, parallel to the bend of the river a mile away. Rifle pits were dug along it, the yellow clay spoil thrown onto logs for breastworks, describing thus a 3-mile arc which enclosed the bluff on the north and the county seat hamlet of Dover on the south, the main supply base. At its weaker and more critical points, as for instance where Indian Creek and the road from Henry pierced its center, chevaux de frise were improvised by felling trees so that they lay with their tops outward, the branches interlaced and sharpened to impale attacking troops. All in all, the line was strong and adequately manned. With the arrival of Floyd's brigade, there were 28 infantry regiments to defend it, a total of 17,500 men, including the artillery and cavalry, with 6 light batteries in addition to the big guns bearing riverward. Floyd had experienced considerable trepidation on coming in, but his success in repulsing attacks against both ends of his line that morning restored his spirits and even sent them soaring. "Our field defenses are good," he wired Johnston. "I think we can sustain ourselves against the land forces." As for his chances against the ironclads, though his batteries turned back a naval reconnaissance that afternoon, he felt less secure. He wired Johnston, "After 2 hours' cannonade, the enemy hauled off their gunboats. We'll commence probably again." He was right. Steaming 4 abreast against his batteries next day, they did indeed commence again. When the squat black bug-shaped vessels opened fire, the cavalry commander Bedford Forrest turned to one of his staff, a former minister. "Parson, for God's sake, pray," he cried. "Nothing but God Almighty can save that fort." Floyd emphatically agreed. In fact, in a telegram which he got off to Johnston while the gunboats were bearing down upon him, he defined what he believed were the limits of his resistance. "The fort cannot hold out 20 minutes." Grant had predicted the immediate fall of Donelson to others beside Halleck. On the day the gunboats took Fort Henry, he told a reporter from Greeley's Tribune, who stopped by headquarters to say goodbye before leaving to file his story in New York, "You had better wait a day or two. I'm going over to capture Fort Donelson tomorrow." This interested the journalist. "How strong is it?" he asked, and Grant replied, "We have not been able to ascertain exactly, but I think we can take it." The reporter would not wait, on the theory that a fort in the hand was worth two in the brush. He made the long trip by river and rail to New York, filed his story, and was back on the banks of the Cumberland before Grant's campaign reached its climax. The initial delay was caused by a number of things, not the least of which was the fact that on the following day, the 7th, in pursuance of his intention to take and destroy the place on the 8th, Grant reconnoitered within a mile of the rifle pits the rebels were digging, and saw for himself the size of the task he was undertaking. To have sent his army forward at once would have meant attacking without the assistance of the gunboats, which would have to make the long trip down the Tennessee and up the Cumberland to Donelson. Besides, the river was still rising, completing the shipwreck of Henry, and threatening to recapture from Grant the spoils he had captured from Tillman, so that his troops, as he reported in explanation, were kept busily engaged in saving what we have from the rapidly rising waters. There was danger in delay. Fort Donelson was being reinforced. Johnston might concentrate and crush him. But Grant was never one to give much weight to such considerations, even when they occurred to him. Meanwhile, his army was growing too. Intent on his chance for command of the West, for which he had already recommended himself in dispatches announcing the capture of Henry and the impending fall of Donelson, Halleck was sending, as he described it, "everything I can rake and scrape together from Missouri." Within a few days, Grant was able to add a brigade to each of his two divisions. On second thought, with 10,000 more reinforcements on the way in transports and Foote's ironclads undergoing repairs at Cairo, he believed that he had more to gain from waiting than from haste, so he waited. All the same, in a letter written on the 9th, he declared that he would keep the ball moving as lively as possible. Hearing that Pillow, whose measure he had taken at Belmont, was now in command of the fort, he added, "I hope to give him a tug before you receive this." By the 11th, he was ready to do just that. Unit commanders received that morning a verbal message. "General Grant sends his compliments and requests to see you this afternoon on his boat." That this headquarters boat was called the New Uncle Sam was something of a coincidence. Uncle Sam had been Grant's academy nickname, derived from his initials, which in turn were accidental. The congressional appointment had identified him as Ulysses Simpson Grant, when in fact his given name was Hiram Ulysses. But rather than try to untangle the yards of red tape that stood in the way of correction, besides the risk of being nicknamed Hug, he let his true name go and took the new one, U.S. Grant. There were accounts of his gallantry under fire in Mexico, and afterwards his colonel had pointed him out on the street with the remark, "There goes a man of fire." However, even for those who had been alongside him at Belmont, these things were not easy to reconcile with the soft-spoken, rather seedy-looking 39-year-old general who received his brigade and division commanders aboard the steamboat. Almost as hard to believe, despite the whiskey lines around his eyes, were the stories of his drinking. 8 years ago this spring, the gossip ran, he had had to resign from the army to avoid dismissal for drunkenness. So broke that he had had to borrow travel money from his future Confederate opponent Simon Buckner, He had gone downhill after that. Successively trying hardscrabble farming outside St. Louis and real estate selling inside it, and failing at both, he went to Galena, Illinois, up in the northwest corner of the state, and was clerking in his father's leather goods store, a confirmed failure with a wife out of a Missouri slave-owning family and two small children, when the war came and gave him a second chance at an army career. He was made a colonel and then a brigadier. "Be careful, Ulyss," his father wrote when he heard the news of the fluke promotion. "You're a general now. It's a good job. Don't lose it." He was quiet, not from secretiveness. He was not really closed-mouthed, but simply because that was his manner, much as another's might be loud. In an army boasting the country's ablest cursors, his strongest expletives were "doggone it" and "by lightning," and even these were sparingly employed. In dress he was plain, even negligent, one of his officers remarked, yet it was noted, in partial amendment, the witness added, that his horse was always a good one and well kept. All his life he had had a way with horses, perhaps because he trusted and understood them. His one outstanding accomplishment at the academy had been the setting of a high jump record on a horse no other cadet would ride. There was an unbuttoned informality about him and about the way he did things, but it involved a good deal more of reticence than congeniality, as if his trust and understanding stopped at horses. The conference aboard the new Uncle Sam, for instance, was as casual as the summons that convened it. What the participants mainly came away with was the knowledge that Grant had told them nothing. He had wanted to find out if they were ready to move out, and apparently he believed he could determine this better by listening than by talking or even asking. He sat and smoked his long-stem meerschaum, appearing to get considerable satisfaction from it, and that was all. The Council of War, calling it such by grace, one participant wrote, broke up and the officers dispersed to their various headquarters, where presently they received the written order. Yet even this was vague. Stating only that the march would begin tomorrow, it gave no starting time and no exact details of attack. The force of the enemy being so variously reported, it closed, the necessary orders will be given in the field. Whatever qualms the troop commanders might be feeling as a result of all this vagueness, the troops themselves, being better accustomed to mystification from above, were in high spirits as the march got underway around mid-morning of Lincoln's birthday. With one quick victory to their credit, in celebration of which they knew the folks at home were already ringing church bells, they looked forward to another, even though it did not give promise of being quite so bloodless as the first. Besides, the sun was out and the air was cool and bracing. They were enjoying the first fine weather they had known since boarding the transports at Paducah 9 days back. The column was light, meaning that there were no wagons for tents or baggage, but the adjective did not apply for the men in ranks, each of whom carried on his person 2 days' rations and 40 rounds of ammunition, in addition to the normal heavy load for winter marching. Glad to be on the move, however burdened, they stepped out smartly with the usual banter back and forth between the various candidates for the role of company clown. Once clear of the river lowlands, they entered a hilly, scrub-oak country that called for up-and-down marching, with pack straps cutting first one way, then another. Presently, as the sun rose higher and bore down harder, and perhaps as much from sheer elation at being young and on the march as from discomfort, they began to shed whatever they thought they could spare. The roads were littered in their wake with discarded blankets and overcoats and other articles not needed in fair weather. Grant shared his men's high spirits. He now had under his command over twice as many men as General Scott had employed in the conquest of Mexico. 15,000 in the marching column, 2,500 left on call at Henry, available when needed, and another 10,000 aboard the transports, making the roundabout river trip to join the overland column on arrival. Undiscouraged at being already 4 days past his previous forecast as to the date the fort would fall, in a telegram to Halleck announcing the launching of the movement, "We start this morning in heavy force," He essayed another, but with something more of caution as well as ambiguity. "I hope to send you a dispatch from Fort Donelson tomorrow." Whether this meant from inside the fort or just in front of it, the words would make pleasant reading for the president on his birthday, in case Halleck passed them along, which he did not. But Grant, who perhaps did not even know it was Lincoln's birthday, had his mind on the problem at hand. He must get to the fort before he could take it or even figure how to take it. He got there a little after noon, the skirmishers coming under sniper fire at the end of the brisk 10-mile hike, and threw his two divisions forward, approaching the spoil-scarred ridge along which the defenders had drawn their curving line of rifle pits. Beyond it, gunfire boomed up off the river, a welcome sound, since it indicated that the Navy had arrived and was applying pressure against the Confederate rear. The 2nd Division, led by Grant's old West Point Commandant C.F. Smith, turned off to the left and took position opposite the northern half of the Rebel arc, while the 1st, under John A. McClernand, filed off to the right and prepared to invest the southern half, where the ridge curved down past Dover. McClernand was a special case with a certain resemblance to the man whose birthday the investment celebrated. An Illinois lawyer-politician, Kentucky-born as well, he had practiced alongside Lincoln in Springfield and on the old 8th Circuit. From that point on, however, the resemblance was less striking. McClernand was not tall, not much taller, in fact, than Grant, but he looked tall, perhaps because of the height of his aspirations. Thin-faced, crowding 50, with sunken eyes and a long knife-blade nose, a glistening full black beard and the genial dignity of an accomplished orator, he had exchanged a seat in Congress for the stars of a brigadier. In addition to the usual patriotic motives, he had a firm belief that the road that led to military glory while the war was on would lead as swiftly to political advancement when it ended. Lincoln had already shown how far a prairie lawyer could go in this country, and McClernand, whose eye for the main chance was about as sharp as Lincoln's own, was quite aware that wars had made presidents before, from Zachary Taylor through Andrew Jackson back to Washington himself. He intended to do all he could to emerge from this, the greatest war of them all, as a continuing instance. So far as this made him zealous, it was good, but it made him overzealous, too, and quick to snatch at laurels. At Belmont, for example, he was one of those who took time out for a victory speech with the battle half won, a speech which was interrupted by the guns across the river, and which, as it turned out, did not celebrate a conquest, but preceded a retreat. He needed watching, and Grant knew it. What was left of the 12th was devoted to completing the investment. The gunboat firing died away, having provoked no reply from the fort. Grant sent a message requesting the fleet to renew the attack next morning as a diversion in our favor, and his men settled down for the night. Dawn came filtering through the woods in front of the ridge, showing once more the yellow scars where the Confederates had emplaced their guns and dug their rifle pits. They were still there. Pickets began exchanging shots, an irregular sequence of popping sounds, each emphasizing the silence before and after, while tendrils of pale, low-lying smoke began to writhe in the underbrush. Near the center, Grant listened. Then there was a sudden clatter off to the right, mounting to quick crescendo with the boom and jar of guns mixed in. McClernand had slipped the leash. His attack, launched against a troublesome battery to his front, was impetuous and headlong. Massed and sent forward at a run, the brigade that made it was caught in a murderous crossfire of artillery and musketry, and fell back, also at a run, leaving its dead and wounded to mark the path of advance and retreat. Old soldiers would have let it go at that, but there were few old soldiers on this field. Twice more the Illinois boys went forward, brave and green, and twice more were repulsed. The only result was to lengthen the casualty lists, and perhaps instruct McClernand that a battery might appear to be exposed, yet be protected. The clatter died away almost as suddenly as it had risen. Once more only the pop-popping of the skirmishers' rifles punctuated the stillness. Presently, in response to Grant's request of the night before, gunboat firing echoed off the river beyond the ridge. To the north, Smith tried his hand at advancing a brigade. At first he was successful, but not for long. The brigade took its objective only to find itself pinned down by such vicious and heavy sniper fire that it had to be withdrawn. The sun declined, and the opposing lines stretched about the same as when it rose. All Grant had really learned from the day's fighting was that the rebels had their backs up and were strong, but he was not discouraged. It was not his way to look much at the gloomy side of things. "I feel every confidence of success," he told Halleck in his final message of the day, "and the best feeling prevails among the men." The feeling did not prevail for long. At dusk, a drizzling rain began to fall. The wind veered clockwise and blew steadily out of the north, turning the rain to sleet and granular snow, and tumbling the thermometer to 20 degrees below freezing. On the windswept ridge, the Confederates shivered in their rifle pits, and in the hollows, northern troops huddled together against the cold, cursing the so-called sunny south, and regretting the blankets and overcoats discarded on the march the day before. Some among the wounded froze to death between the lines, locked in rigid agony under the soft down-sift of snow. When dawn came through, luminous and ghostly, the men emerged from their holes to find a wonderland that seemed not made for fighting. The trees wore icy armor, branch and twig, and the countryside was blanketed with white. Grant was not discomforted by the cold. He spent the night in a big feather bed set up in the warm kitchen of a farmhouse. But he had worries enough to cause him to toss and turn, whether he actually did so or not, without the weather adding more. The gunboat firing of the past 2 days had had none of the reverberating violence of last week's assault on Henry, and this was due to something beside acoustic difficulties. It was due, rather, to the fact that there was only one gunboat on hand. The others, along with a dozen transports bearing reinforcements, were still somewhere downriver. Their failure to arrive left Grant in the unorthodox position of investing a fortified camp with fewer troops than the enemy had inside it. During the night he sent word back to Henry for the 2,500 men left there to be brought forward. That at least would equalize the armies, though it was still a far cry from the 3-to-1 advantage which the tactics books advised. They arrived at daybreak, and Grant assigned them to Smith, one of whose brigades had been used to strengthen McClernand. Doubtless Grant was glad to see them, but then even more welcome news arrived from the opposite direction. The fleet had come up in the night and was standing by while the transports unloaded reinforcements. Presently these two arrived, glad to be stretching their legs ashore after their long, cramped tour of the rivers. Grant consolidated them into a 3rd Division and assigned it to Lew Wallace, one of Smith's brigade commanders, who had been left in charge at Henry and had made the swift, cold march to arrive at dawn. A former Indiana lawyer, the 34-year-old brigadier wore a large, fierce black mustache and chin beard to disguise his youth and his literary ambitions, though so far neither had retarded his climb up the military ladder. Grant put this division into line between the 1st and 2nd, sidestepping them right and left to make room, and thickening ranks in the process. Along that snow-encrusted front, with its ice-clad trees like inverted cut-glass chandeliers beneath which men crouched shivering in frost-stiffened garments and blew on their gloveless hands for warmth, he now had 3 divisions facing the Confederate 2, 11 brigades investing 7, 27,500 troops in blue opposing 17,500 in gray. They were not enough, perhaps, to assure a successful all-out assault. He was still only halfway to the prescribed 3-to-1 advantage, and after yesterday's bloody double repulse he rather doubted the wisdom of trying to storm that fortified line. But now at last the fleet was up, the fleet which had humbled Henry in short order, and that made all the difference. Surely he had enough men to prevent the escape of the rebel garrison when the ironclads started knocking the place to pieces. Shortly after noon, by which time he had all his soldiers in position under orders to prevent a breakout, he sent word to the naval commander, requesting an immediate assault by the gunboats. Then he mounted his horse and rode to a point on the high west bank of the Cumberland, beyond the northern end of his line, where he would have a grandstand seat for the show. Foote would have preferred to wait until he had had time to make a personal reconnaissance, but Grant's request was for an immediate attack, and the Commodore prepared to give it to him. He had done considerable waiting already, a whole week of it, while the armorers were hammering his ironclads back into shape. All this time he had kept busy, supervising the work, replenishing supplies, and requisitioning seafaring men to replace 30 freshwater sailors who skedaddled to avoid gunboat duty. Nor were spiritual matters neglected. 3 days after the Henry bombardment, he attended church at Cairo, where, being told that the parson was indisposed, Foote mounted to the pulpit and preached the sermon himself. "Let not your heart be troubled," was his text. "Ye believe in God, believe also in me." Next day, having thus admonished and fortified his crews, he sent one ironclad up the Cumberland, the Carondelet, a veteran of Henry, while he waited at Cairo to bring three more, the flagship St. Louis, another Henry veteran, and the Pittsburgh and the Louisville, replacements for the Cincinnati, which remained on guard at the captured fort, and the Hardluck Essex, which had been too vitally hurt to share in a second attempt at quick reduction. It took the Commodore 2 more days to complete repairs, replace the runaway sailors, and assemble his revamped flotilla, including 2 of the long-range wooden gunboats and the 12 transports loaded with infantry reinforcements. Then on the 13th he went forward, southward up the Cumberland in the wake of the Carondelet, whose skipper was waiting to report on his 2-day action when Foote arrived before midnight at the bend just north of Donelson. The report had both its good points and its bad, though the former were predominant. On the first day, when the Carondelet steamed alone against the fort, firing to signal her presence to Grant, who was just arriving, there was no reply from the batteries on the bluff. The earthworks seemed deserted, their frowning guns untended. All the same, the captain hadn't liked the looks of them. They reminded him, he said later, of the dismal-looking sepulchres cut into the rocky cliffs near Jerusalem, but far more repulsive. He retired, answered only by echoes booming the sound of his own shots back from the hills, and anchored for the night 3 miles downstream. It was strange, downright eerie. Next morning, though, in accordance with a request from Grant, who evidently had not known there was only one gunboat at hand, he went forward again, hearing the landward clatter of musketry as McClernand's attack was launched and repulsed. On this second approach, the Carondelet drew fire from every battery on the heights. Under bombardment for 2 hours, she got off 139 rounds and received only 2 hits in return. This was poor gunnery on the enemy's part, but one of those hits gave the captain, and in turn the Commodore, warning of what a gun on that bluff could do to an ironclad on the river below. It was a 128-pound solid shot, and it crashed through a broadside casemate into the engine room, where it caromed and ricocheted, ripping at steam pipes and railings, knocking down 12 men and bounding after the others, as one of the engineers said, like a wild beast pursuing its prey. Shattering beams and timbers, it filled the air with splinters fine as needles, pricking and stabbing the sailors through their clothes, though in all the grim excitement they were not aware of this until they felt the blood running into their shoes. The Carondelet fell back to transfer her wounded and attend to emergency repairs, but when the racket of another land assault broke out at the near end of the line, she came forward again, firing 45 more rounds at the batteries, and then drew off unhit as the clatter died away, signifying that Smith's attack, like McClernand's, had not succeeded. Aboard the flagship, Foote had the rest of the night and the following morning in which to evaluate this information. Then came the request for an immediate assault. As Grant designed it, the fleet would silence the guns on the bluff, then steam on past the fort and take position opposite Dover, blocking any attempt at retreat across the river while it shelled the rebels out of their rifle pits along the lower ridge, whereupon the army would throw its right wing forward so that the defenders, cut off from their main base of supplies and barred from retreat in either direction, could then be chewed up by gunfire front and rear, or simply be outsat until they starved or saw the wisdom of surrender. The Commodore would have preferred to have more time for preparation, time in which to give a final honing, as it were, to the naval blade of the amphibious shears, but for all he knew, Grant had special reasons for haste. Besides, he admired the resolute simplicity of the plan. It was just his style of fighting. Once the water batteries were reduced, it would go like clockwork, and the example of Henry 8 days back assured him that the hard part would be over in a hurry. He agreed to make the assault at once. One thing he took time to do, however, chains, lumber, and bags of coal, all the hard materials in the vessels, as one skipper said, were laid on the ironclad's upper decks to give additional protection from such plunging shots as the one that had come bounding through the engine room of the Carondelet. This done, Foote gave the signal, and at 3 o'clock the fleet moved to the attack, breasting the cold, dark water of the river flowing northward between the snow-clad hills, where spectators from both armies were assembling for the show. One was Floyd, who took one look at the gunboats bearing down and declared that the fort was doomed. Another was Grant, who said nothing. They came as they had come at Henry, the ironclads out in front, 4 abreast, while the brittle-skinned wooden gunboats Tyler and Conestoga brought up the rear, 1,000 yards astern. At 1.5 miles, the batteries opened fire with their 2 big guns, churning the water ahead of the line of boats, but Foote did not reply until the range was closed to 1 mile. Then the flagship opened with her bow guns, echoed at once by the others, darting tongues of flame and steaming steadily forward, under orders to close the range until the batteries were silenced. Muzzles flashing and smoke boiling up as if the bluff itself were ablaze, the Confederates stood to their guns, encouraged by yesterday's success against the Carondelet, just as Henry's gunners had been heartened by turning back the Essex on the day before their battle. The resemblance did not stop there, however. After the first few long-range shots, as in the fallen fort 1 week ago, the big 128-pounder rifle on the crest of the bluff, the gun that had scored the only hit in 2 days of firing, was spiked by its own priming wire, which an excited cannoneer left in the vent while a round was being rammed. This left only the 2 short-range 32-pounder carronades in the upper battery, and the 10-inch Columbiad and 8 smooth-bore 32-pounders in the lower. 1 fixed target opposing 4 in motion, each of which carried more guns between her decks than the bluff had in all, plus the long-range wooden gunboats arching their shells from beyond the smoke-wreathed line of ironclads. Foote kept coming, firing as he came. At closer range, the St. Louis and Pittsburgh in the middle, the Carondelet and Louisville on the flanks. His vessels were taking hits, the metallic clang of iron on iron echoing from the surrounding hills with the din of a giant forge. But he could also see dirt and sandbags flying from the enemy embrasures as his shots struck home, and he believed he saw men running in panic from the lower battery. The Confederate fire was slackening, he afterwards reported. Another 15 minutes and the bluff would be reduced. It may have been so, but he would never know. He was not allowed those 15 minutes. At 500 yards, the rebel fire was faster and far more effective, riddling stacks and lifeboats, shearing away flagstaffs and davits, scattering the coal and lumber and scrap iron on the decks. The sloped bulwarks caused the plunging shots to strike not at glancing angles, as had been intended, but perpendicular, and the gunboats shuddered under the blows. Head-on fire was shucking away side armor, one captain said, as lightning tears the bark from a tree. At 1/4 mile, just as Foote thought he saw signs of panic among the defenders, a solid shot crashed through the flagship's superstructure, carrying away the wheel, killing the pilot, and wounding the Commodore and everyone else in the pilot house except an agile reporter who had come along as acting secretary. The St. Louis faltered, having no helm to answer, and went away with the current out of the fight. Alongside her, the Pittsburgh had her tiller ropes shot clean away. She too careened off, helmless, taking more hits as she swung. The Louisville was the next to go, struck hard between wind and water. Her compartments kept her from sinking while her crew patched up the holes, but then, like her two sister ships, she lost her steering gear and wore off downstream. Left to face the batteries alone, at 200 yards the Carondelet came clumsily about, her forward compartments logged with water from the holes punched in her bow, and fell back down the river, firing rapidly and wildly as she went, not so much in hopes of damaging the enemy as in an attempt to hide in the smoke from her own guns. High on the bluff, the Confederates were elated. In the later stages of the fight, they enjoyed comparative immunity, for as the gunboats closed the range, they overshot the batteries. Drawing near, they presented easier targets, and the cannoneers stood to their pieces, delivering hit after hit and cheering as they did so. "Now, boys," one gunner cried, "see me take a chimney." He drew a bead, and down went a smokestack. One after another, the squat, fire-breathing ironclads were disabled, wallowing helplessly as the current swept them northward, until finally the Carondelet made her frantic run for safety, firing indiscriminately to wreathe herself in smoke. The river was deserted. The fight was over quite as suddenly as it started. The flagship had taken 57 hits, the others about as many. 54 sailors were casualties, including 11 dead. In the batteries, on the other hand, though the breastworks had been knocked to pieces, not a man or a gun was lost. The artillerists cheered and tossed their caps and kept on cheering. Fort Henry had shown what the gunboats could do. Fort Donelson had shown what they could not do. The Confederate commander was as jubilant as his gunners. When the tide of battle turned, he recovered his spirits and wired Johnston, "The fort holds out. 3 gunboats have retired, only 1 firing now." When that one had retired as well, his elation was complete. It was otherwise with Grant, who saw in the rout of the ironclads a disruption of his plans. Mounting his horse, he rode back to headquarters and reported by wire to Halleck's chief of staff in Cairo, "Appearances indicate now that we will have a protracted siege here." A siege was undesirable, but the rugged terrain and the bloody double repulse already suffered in front of the fortified ridge caused him to fear the result of an attempt to carry the place by storm with raw troops. Meanwhile, he reported, he was ordering up more ammunition and strengthening the investment for what might be a long, drawn-out affair. Disappointed but not discouraged, he assured the theater commander, "I feel great confidence in ultimately reducing the place." Glorious as the exploit had been, Floyd's elation was based on more than the repulse of the flotilla. Since the night before, he had had the satisfaction of knowing that he had successfully accomplished the first half of his primary assignment, his reason for being at Donelson in the first place. He had kept Grant's army off Hardee's flank during the retreat from Bowling Green. Johnston was in Nashville with the van, and Hardee was closing fast with the rear, secure from western molestation. Now there remained only the second half of Floyd's assignment, to extract his troops from their present trap for an overland march to join in the defense of the Tennessee capital. This was obviously no easy task, but he had begun to plan for it at a council of war that morning, when he and his division commanders decided to try for a breakout south of Dover, where a road led south, then east toward Nashville, 70 miles away. Pillow's division would be massed for the assault, while Buckner's pulled back to cover the withdrawal. Troop dispositions had already begun when the ironclads came booming up the river. By the time they had been repulsed, the day was too far gone. Floyd sent orders canceling the attack and calling another council of war. No experienced soldier himself, he wanted more advice from those who were. The two who were there to give it to him were about as different from each other as any 2 men in the Confederacy. Pillow was inclined toward the manic, addicted to breathing fire on the verge of combat, flamboyant in address. He was ever sanguine in expectations and eager for desperate ventures, the more desperate the better. Buckner was gloomy, saturnine, not much given to seeking out excitement. He was inclined to examine the odds on any gamble, especially when they were as long as they were now. Some of the difference perhaps was due to the fact that Pillow the Tennessean was fighting to save his native state, his country, as he called it, while Buckner the Kentuckian had just seen his abandoned, and their relationship was complicated by the fact that there was bad blood between them, dating from back in the Mexican War, when Buckner had joined not only in the censure of Pillow for laying claim to exploits not his own, but also in the laughter which followed a report that had him digging a trench on the wrong side of a parapet. Between these two, the confident Pillow and the cautious Buckner, Floyd swung first one way, then another, approaching nervous exhaustion in the process. The indecision he had displayed in West Virginia under Lee was being magnified at Donelson, together with his tendency to grow flustered under pressure. Just now, however, with the rout of the Yankee gunboats to his credit, he was inclined to share his senior general's expectations. Adjourning the council, he announced that the breakout designed for today would be attempted at earliest dawn tomorrow. Even the gloomy Buckner admitted there was no other way to save the army, though he strongly doubted its chances for success. All night the generals labored, shifting troops for the dawn assault. Pillow massed his division in attack formation south of Dover, while Buckner stripped the northward ridge of men and guns to cover the withdrawal once the Union right had been rolled back to open the road toward Nashville. Another storm came up in the night, freezing the soldiers thus exposed. Yet this had its advantages. The wind howled down the shouts of command, and the snowfall muffled the footsteps of the men and the clang of gun wheels on the frozen ground. No noise betrayed the movement to the Federals, huddled in pairs for warmth and sleep beyond the nearly deserted ridge. As dawn came glimmering through the icy lacework of the underbrush and trees, Pillow sent his regiments forward on schedule, Forrest's cavalry riding and slashing on the flank. They met stiff resistance, not because the Yankees were expecting this specific attack, but because they were well disciplined and alert. For better than 3 hours, the issue hung in raging doubt, the points of contact clearly marked by bloodstains on the snow. Running low on ammunition, McClernand's men gave way, fought out, and as they fell back, sidling off to the left and exposing in turn the right flank of Wallace, Pillow saw that he had achieved his objective. The Nashville road was open. He paused to send a telegram to Johnston. On the honor of a soldier, the day is ours. However, having paused, he took stock, and it was as if the telegram had used up his last ounce of energy and hope, both of which had formerly seemed boundless. For now, a strange thing happened. He and Buckner exchanged roles. Now it was Pillow who was pessimistic, fearing a counterattack against his flank while moving through the gap, and Buckner who was ebullient, declaring that the success should be exploited by ramming the column through. He had brought his soldiers forward to hold the door ajar. He could do it, he said, and in fact he insisted on doing it. When Pillow, standing on seniority, ordered him back to his former position, he refused to go. It was nearing noon by now, and all this time the road was standing open. While the generals stood there wrangling, Floyd arrived. Smooth-shaven, with a pendulous underlip, he stood between them, looking from one to the other while they appealed to him to settle the dispute. At first he agreed with Buckner and told him to stay where he was, holding the escape hatch ajar. Then Pillow took him aside and he reversed himself, ordering both divisions back into line on the ridge. The morning's fight had gone for nothing, together with the bloodstains on the snow. Elsewhere along the curving front, practically stripped of Confederate troops for the breakthrough concentration, the sector formerly held by Buckner's whole division, for example, had been left in charge of a single regiment with fewer than 500 men, the lines across the way were strangely silent. To the Southerners, widely spaced along the ridge, this seemed a special dispensation of Providence. Actually, however, the basis for the respite, though unusual, was entirely natural. Before daylight that morning, Grant had received a note from Flag Officer Foote requesting an interview. The wounded Commodore was going back downriver for repairs, both to his worst-hit vessels and to himself, and he wanted to talk with Grant before he left. Grant rode northward to meet him aboard the flagship, having, he said later, no idea that there would be any engagement on land unless I brought it on myself. He left explicit orders that his division commanders were not to move from their present positions. Baffled by the wintry trees and ridges, the three-hour uproar of Pillow's assault on the opposite end of the line reached him faintly, if at all. He rode on. Hard-pressed, McClernand was calling for help, which Grant's orders prohibited Wallace and Smith from sending, though the former, on his own responsibility, finally sent a brigade which helped to blunt the attack when his own lines were assailed. Grant knew nothing of this until past noon, when, riding back from the gunboat conference, he met a staff captain who informed him, white-faced with alarm, that McClernand's division had been struck and scattered into full retreat. Grant put spurs to his horse. Speed was impossible on the icy road, however, even for so skillful a horseman as Grant. It was 1 o'clock before he reached the near end of his line, where he found reassurance in the lack of excitement among the troops of Smith's division. Even Wallace's men, already engaged in part, showed fewer signs of panic than the captain who had met him crying havoc. McClernand's next in sight were another matter. They had been ousted from their position, taking some rough handling in the process, and they showed it. Now that the rebels had stopped shoving, they stopped running, but as they stood around in leaderless clumps, empty cartridge boxes on display as an excuse for having yielded, they gave little evidence of wanting to regain what they had lost. There was a report that Confederate prisoners had 3 days' cooked rations in their haversacks. Some took this as proof that they were prepared for 3 days of hard fighting. But Grant had a different interpretation. He believed it meant that they were trying to escape, and he believed further that they were more demoralized by having failed in a desperate venture than his own men were by a temporary setback. "The one who attacks first now will be victorious," he said to his staff, "and the enemy will have to be in a hurry if he gets ahead of me." He told McClernand's men, "Fill your cartridge boxes quick and get into line. The enemy is trying to escape, and he must not be permitted to do so." This worked, he said later, like a charm. The men only wanted someone to give them a command. To the wounded Foote went a request that the gunboats make appearance and throw a few shells at long range. He did not expect them to stage a real attack, he added, but he counted on the morale effect, both on his own troops and the enemy's, of hearing naval gunfire from the river. Reasoning also that the rebels must have stripped the ridge to mass for the attack on the south, he rode to the far end of the line and ordered Smith to charge, advising him that he would find only a very thin line to contend with. This was what Smith had been waiting for, and for various reasons. His bright blue eyes and oversized snowy mustache standing out in contrast to his high-colored face. He was regular army to the shoe soles, the only man in the Western Theater, one of his fellow officers said, who could ride along a line of volunteers in the regulation uniform of a brigadier general, plume, chapeau, epaulettes and all, without exciting laughter. Like many old army men, since that army had been predominantly Southern in tone, he was suspected of disloyalty. But Smith, who had been thrice brevetted for bravery in Mexico, was not disturbed by these suspicions. "They'll take it back after our first battle," he promised. And now, with that first battle in progress, he got his troops into line, gave them orders not to fire until the rebel abattis had been cleared, and led them forward. High on his horse, the 60-year-old general turned from time to time in the saddle to observe the alignment and gesture with his sword, the bullets of the sharpshooters twittering round him. "I was nearly scared to death," one soldier afterwards said, "but I saw the old man's white mustache over his shoulder and went on." They all went on, through the fallen timber and up the ridge where they drove back the regiment Buckner had left to man the line. All that kept them from storming the fort itself was the arrival of the rest of Buckner's division, which Floyd had ordered back. On the right, McClernand's rallied men hurried the retirement of Pillow, reoccupying the ground they had lost. Wallace took a share in this, shouting as he rode along the line of his division, "You have been wanting a fight. You have got it. Hell's before you." Two of the battered ironclads reappeared around the bend in answer to Grant's request, lobbing long-range shells to add to the Confederate confusion. In what remained of the short winter afternoon, since saying the one who attacks first now will be victorious, Grant saw his army not only recover from the morning's reverses, but breach the line of rebel entrenchments as well. By daylight there would be Union artillery on the ridge where Smith had forced a lodgment. The fort, the water battery, Dover itself. The whole Confederate position would be under those guns. It was not going to be a siege, after all. This was realized as well by the commanders inside the fort, swinging once more from elation to dejection, as it was by those outside. At the Council of War, held late that night in the framed two-story Dover Inn, the prime reaction was consternation. Pillow and Buckner had reverted to their original roles. The former had thrown off his gloom, the latter his ebullience, and each accused the other of having failed to exploit the morning's gains. Pillow declared that he had halted only to send his men back after their equipment. He was ready to cut his way out in earnest all over again. Buckner said that stopping, for whatever reason, had been fatal. The Federals had restored the line, and his men were too dispirited to make another assault. Floyd was as usual in the middle, looking from one to the other as the recriminations passed him. This time, though, he sided more with Buckner. Smith's guns were on the ridge by now, waiting for dawn to define the targets. Forrest, who was present in his capacity as cavalry commander, reported that a riverside road was open to the south, though icy backwater stood waist-deep where it crossed a creek bed. However, the army surgeon, who had yet to learn just how tough a creature the Confederate soldier could be despite his grousing, advised against using the flooded road, predicting that such exposure would be fatal to the troops. Then, too, there was a report that Grant had received another 10,000 reinforcements. Floyd already believed his men were outnumbered 4-1, and as far as he was concerned, that settled the matter. Only one course remained: to surrender the command. Whatever their differences at this final conference, he and Pillow were agreed at least on the question of personal surrender. Neither would have any part of it, and each had his reasons. Floyd had been indicted for malfeasance in office as Secretary of War. The charge had been null prost, but it might very well be reopened in a wartime atmosphere. Besides, it was a matter of general belief in the North that he had diverted Federal arms and munitions to Southern arsenals on the eve of secession. To surrender would be to throw himself on a mercy which he considered non-existent. Pillow's was a different case, but he was no less determined to avoid captivity. Having sworn that he would never surrender, he intended to keep his oath. He agreed by now as to the necessity for surrender of the army, but like Floyd, he refused to be included. His battle cry was liberty or death, and he chose liberty. Buckner felt otherwise. He accepted the facing of possible charges of treason as one of the hazards of waging a revolution. Also, he had done the Federal commander certain personal services, including the loan of money when Grant was on his way home from California in disgrace, and this might have a happy effect when the two sat down together to arrange terms for capitulation. He would surrender the army and himself as part of it, along with all the others who had fought here and been worsted. The necessary change of commanders was effected in order of rank. "I turn the command over, sir," Floyd told Pillow. "I pass it," Pillow told Buckner. "I assume it," Buckner said. "Give me pen, ink, and paper, and send for a bugler." This colloquy omitted a fourth member of the council. Bedford Forrest rose up in his wrath. "I did not come here for the purpose of surrendering my command," he declared. Buckner agreed that the cavalryman could lead his men out if the movement began before surrender negotiations were underway. Forrest stamped out into the night, followed by Floyd and Pillow, while Buckner composed his note to Grant. In consideration of all the circumstances governing the present situation of affairs at this station, I propose to the commanding officer of the Federal forces the appointment of commissioners to agree upon the terms of capitulation of the forces and fort under my command, and in that view suggest an armistice until 12 o'clock today. He signed it, "Very respectfully, your obedient servant." Buckner's men by no means shared his gloom. Except for the regiment overrun by Smith's division, they had whipped the Yankees on land and water each time they had come to grips. Rested from the previous day's exertions, they expected a renewal of the fight. Consequently, the bugler going forward to sound the parley and the messenger bearing Buckner's note and a white flag of truce had trouble getting through the lines. At last they did, however. The bugle rang out, plaintive in the frosty night, and men of the Northern 2nd Division received them and gave them escort back to the division commander. Smith read the note and set out at once through the chill pre-dawn darkness for the farmhouse, which was Army headquarters. Grant was snug in his feather bed when Smith came in, saying, "There's something for you to read." During the reading, the old soldier crossed to the open fire and stroked his mustache while warming his boots and backside. Grant gave a short laugh. "Well, what do you think of it?" he asked. Smith said, "I think no terms with the traitors, by God." Grant slipped out of bed and drew on his outer garments. Then he took a sheet of tablet paper and began to write. When he had finished, he handed it to Smith, who read it by firelight and pronounced abruptly, "By God, it couldn't be better." Once more, the truce party crossed the lines, headed now in the opposite direction as they picked their way to the Dover Inn, where Buckner was waiting to learn Grant's terms. There had been considerable bustle in their absence. A steamboat had arrived in the night, bringing a final batch of 400 reinforcements, who landed thus in time to be surrendered. Floyd commandeered the vessel for the evacuation of his brigade, 4 regiments from his native Virginia and 1 from Mississippi, the latter being assigned to guard the landing while the others got aboard. The first 2 regiments of Virginians had been deposited safely on the other shore. The boat had returned and the 2nd pair were being loaded when word came from Buckner that surrender negotiations had been opened. All who were going must go at once. Floyd hurried aboard with his staff and gave the signal and the steamboat backed away, leaving the Mississippians howling ruefully on the bank. Pillow had been less fortunate. The best transportation he could find was an abandoned scow with barely room for himself and his chief of staff, and they were the only 2 from his command who got away in the night. Forrest, on the other hand, took not only all of his own men, but also a number of infantrymen who swung up behind the troopers, riding double across low stretches where the water was saddle-skirt deep, as Forrest said. He believed the whole army could have escaped by this route, the venture he had urged at the Council of War only to be overruled. "Not a gun was fired at us," he reported. "Not an enemy was seen or heard." Sitting and waiting was the harder task, and it was Buckner's. The first Confederate general to submit a request for surrender terms from an opponent, he knew what condemnation was likely to be heaped upon his head by his own people, who would see only that he had ordered his men to lay down their arms in the face of bloody fighting. Yet he took some consolation and found much hope in the fact that those terms would come from an old West Point comrade whom he had befriended in another time of trial, when the tide of fortune was running the other way. The truce messenger returned at last and handed him Grant's reply. "Headquarters Army in the Field, Camp near Donelson, February 16th. General S.B. Buckner, Confederate Army. Sir, yours of this date proposing armistice and appointment of commissioners to settle terms of capitulation is just received. No terms except an unconditional and immediate surrender can be accepted. I propose to move immediately upon your works. I am, sir, very respectfully, your obedient servant, U.S. Grant, Brigadier General." This was not at all what Buckner had expected by way of return for favors past. Neither generous nor chivalrous, even aside from personal obligations, Such terms, which were in effect hardly terms at all, were a far cry from those extended by Beauregard 10 months ago at Sumter, back in what already seemed a different war entirely, when Anderson was allowed to salute his flag and march out under arms, while the victors lined the beaches and stood uncovered to watch him go. Yet there was nothing Buckner could do about it. Floyd and Pillow had left, which might have been considered good riddance, except that the former had taken 4/5 of his brigade, lengthening the odds, and Forrest was gone with his hard-hitting cavalry, which otherwise might have covered a retreat. All that remained was for Buckner to make a formal protest and submit. This he did, informing Grant that the scattering of his own troops and the overwhelming forces under your command compel me, notwithstanding the brilliant success of the Confederate arms yesterday, to accept the ungenerous and unchivalrous terms which you propose. By now it was broad open daylight. Receiving the message, Grant rode forward, past white flags stuck at intervals along the rebel line, into Dover, where he found Lew Wallace already sharing a cornbread and coffee breakfast with the Confederates at the inn. He joined the friendly discussion, and when Buckner remarked that if he had been in charge during the fighting, the Federals would not have got up to Donelson as easily as they had done, Grant replied that if such had been the case, I should not have tried it the way I did. Then he took over the inn as his own headquarters. Before sending Buckner north, however, he sought to make amends by offering his prisoner, who had done the same for him when the degrees of fortune and misfortune were reversed, the use of his purse. The Kentuckian declined it. The actual surrender was accomplished without formality. One northern correspondent observed a marked difference between rebels from the border states and those from farther south. Moving among them, he noted that the former were not much